This is KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM.
Below Your Knees by Ray Lynch, and that tells us that it is 6 p.m. Wednesday and time for So What's Your Story, the only program originating in Houston devoted to storytelling. We are aired only on Houston's community station, KPFT 90.1 FM here in Houston, or kpft.org, HD1 on the internet. I am Mary Edgerton, tonight's host, and along with the best team on radio, we celebrate the power of story by placing the spotlight on tellers whose stories take us on fabulous and fantastic journeys before returning us safely to the present. Today, January 3rd, is a special day for me. It is the 109th anniversary of my father's birth. George Edgerton was many things, of which one was being a great storyteller. He held us children rapt as he read Dr. Doolittle books to us with a distinct voice for each animal. Christmas was wonderful because there was always a new Caldecott winner book under the tree that he would read to us, not to mention some older books from his own childhood, now out of print, such as Peter and Prue. Children's stories and fables were not his only genre. There were his own childhood stories, one of my favorite one being about how he and his younger brother were worried that the air would get used up by all the people living on Earth. They did their best to help rectify this problem by taking a bicycle tire pump and working away at replenishing the air. There were more serious life stories about growing up during the Depression and going off to the Pacific during World War II, not to mention a tremendous wealth of family history handed down in the oral tradition. So let me raise a glass to my father, who we affectionately called Murr, and no, his name was not Murphy, with many thanks for all the stories and for handing down the tradition of storytelling. I was lucky to find a storyteller who has the breadth of stories from folk tales, where she uses special voices and exhilarating descriptions, to stories from her life, from childhood to adulthood. The following set of stories warmed my heart as I drifted through her worlds in the same way my father had taken us through his. I now introduce you to Neshama Franklin. I have left this recording of our storytelling almost completely unedited just because I loved the feeling that it gave for me today in being able to remember my father on the date of his birth, January 3rd. Neshama Franklin. First, I have to say that's an unusual name, Neshama. How did you get that name?
I chose it, but it was given to me, a paradox. When my parents were new immigrants and they wanted to be like everybody else, and it turned out that everybody else was named either Susan or Nancy. And so I knew as soon as I came to language, it wasn't my name. And, you know, I tried on lots of different names, and then they made the mistake of telling me I had a Hebrew name, and they were not practicing Jews, but still it's, you know, part of the family. And they said, your name is Nechama. And I said, that's my name. And they went, and so it took me, I couldn't claim it completely until I was out of elementary school and into junior high. And then I became Nikki because it was cute. But from that day to this, which was a long time ago, I never changed it legally. And no one has ever said, you know, how did the Susan Rosenbaum get to be Neshama Franklin? It's just all like butter. So I claim my name.
No, that's a beautiful name, Nahama.
But then my dance teacher, African American, Donnie McHale, said, nobody can go the, you're Neshama. And I said, sure. And it turns out they're not that different, you know.
Right.
Meanings are similar.
Right. You know, my second husband was Jewish, was from Brooklyn. He's the father of my daughters, and I raised his two boys, and we're no longer married, but we were together, I don't know, 24 years or so. Anyway, when I first met him, and I'm this little shiksa from Texas, he would say, "I'm going to go to the bakery and get holly bread." And I'm thinking, now, why is a Jewish man buying a Christmas bread? You know? And then I took a little while, but I realized it was what I called challah bread, but it's challah bread, yeah. And he called it holly. Anyway, so where do you want to start? Do you want to start with that?
Well, let me tell you, I usually plunge right into the story without a title. Do you guys want titles?
I don't like a title. I love these plunges. Let's take a plunge.
Here comes the first one. Simon didn't like fish. Simon hated fish. And this was unfortunate because he lived in a small coastal town and all you could do was fish. And he had 15 brothers and sisters to support. He was the main breadwinner, or you could say fish winner. And so he went out with his boss, who was very mean, in the boat every day. And his job was to pull up the nets. Now, one day into the net, he saw the most extraordinary fish, huge with rainbow stripes and golden eyes. And he knew that this was a special fish. And he just, out of absolute instinct, picked up the fish, two arms, that's how big it was, and flipped it back into the ocean. And just before the fish dove under the waves, the fish winked at him. Now, the boss was looking at this with fury and said, "That was a very expensive fish. Are you stupid or something? You're fired." And back to the shore he went and dropped poor Simon off. And Simon, he could not face his 15 brothers and sisters. And he just walked up and down the beach full of despair. And all of a sudden, there was a whoosh and a clatter. And in front of him was something, someone, someone you don't want to see, someone who had not skin, but a skull, someone who was made of bones. You could see them sticking out of his long black coat. Someone who had no eyes in the eye sockets, but a lot of bright white teeth. And Simon knew who this person, this being, this creature was. And he said, No, I'm just too young. And I have 15 brothers and sisters to support." And Death, because indeed that's who it was, said, "Don't worry, don't worry. My job is so hard and it's very tiring. And once in a while I see somebody in distress and I like to do something nice. It kind of balances out my hard life. And so I want to give you a cow." Simon said, "A cow?" "Yes," said Death, "this is a cow that's supposed to give a lot of milk." And Simon said, "Well, what's the catch?" And Death said, "Oh, no catch, no catch. You can keep this cow for 7 years. I bet you'll do well with this cow." "And what about happens after the 7 years?" "Well, I come back," said Death, "and I'll ask you three questions. And if you answer those questions, you can keep the cow. And if you don't answer those questions right," and he made that gesture, finger across the throat. And everybody knows what that means. And so what could Simon do? They shook on it. It was very unpleasant to shake with a handful of bones. And whoosh, that figure was gone. And oh, in its spot was this cow, big, beautiful cow, curving horns, bulging udder, rope around its neck. And he just gave that rope a little tug, and the cow trotted right behind him all the way home. And the 15 brothers and sisters were flabbergasted. They said, "Well, why aren't you coming up with a fish? And where did you get that cow?" And Simon said, "It's a long story, but she's supposed to be a good milker. Let's see what she can produce." And you know, they actually had a milking stool, and one of the sisters sat down and started to milk, and out gushed this rich, foamy, delicious milk. And they all had cupfuls. It went down so well, they hadn't had fresh milk like this for perhaps ever. And then the bucket got filled up. "Let's see what she can do." And so they pulled out every pot and pan and bucket and receptacle that they had around, and soon they were surrounded by lots and lots of foamy, rich milk. What do we do with this milk? I mean, we can sell this milk, but let's make cheese, said one of the really smart sisters. And so they sold the milk, they made the cheese, and oh, they really got good at cheese making. Yellow cheese, white cheese, hard cheese, soft cheese. They sold the milk, they sold the cheese, they learned how to make ice cream. Oh, that went over very well. And soon they were rich. What do we do with this money? Well, let's start a restaurant. Everybody is sick of fish. That's the only thing we won't serve. And so the restaurant was bustling. It was such a happy time for this family and the town. And you know how time flies when you're having fun and everything is settled down? The 7 years was upon us. Now, it was a Monday night, and in the restaurant trade, things are slow. No matter how good the restaurant is, things are slow on Monday night. And there was only one patron of the restaurant, a very tall woman in a rainbow striped dress. And she had just sat down, was ready to place her order when, yes, indeed, it was a dark and stormy night. There was a, and the door flew open. And you know who was standing there with his skull and his black coat and his bony fingers. And he looked at Simon, and Simon was shocked. He had actually forgotten all about this. And Death said, "Here I am. Are you ready to answer my questions?" And the woman looked up and said, "Yes, he is." Death was very shocked. And she said, and you know, that was your first question. He said to Simon, "Are you going to let this woman answer for you?" And she looked up and said, "Yes, I am." And that was your second question. And Death couldn't stand it. He said, "Who in whoever's name are you?" And she stood up. Oh, she was so tall. Her head grazed the roof of the restaurant, and her dress seemed to glitter and glow with rainbow stripes. And she said, "I am Queen of the Seas. And 7 years ago, Simon saved my life, and now I'm saving his." What could Death do? With a furious whoosh and a clatter, he was gone. And Simon, he got to keep the cow, and they all lived very long and happy lives.
That's the gift that you keep on giving on, that you give it forward, right?
Exactly. Ready for the second story?
Sure, let's do it.
Okay. Zomo the rabbit, he's not very big, he's not very strong, he's pretty clever, he's rather fast. But you know, he wanted more, this little rabbit. He actually wanted wisdom. And where do you get wisdom? From the sky god. And Zomo had a kind of connection with the sky god. So he went up there and he said to the sky god, "I want wisdom. Can you give me wisdom?" And the sky god looked down and rather amused. And he said, "Oh, little Zomo, you don't just get vision. You don't just get wisdom. You have to earn it." "Well, how do I do that?" said Zomo. "Well," said sky god, "you have to do three impossible tasks." "What are they?" said Zomo. "Well," said Sky God, "you have to get scales of the big fish, you have to get milk of the wild cow, and you have to get tooth of that, you know, terrible leopard." And Zomo went, and he said, "I really want that wisdom. I will do it." And so he went off. Because he was clever, he went down, of course, to the seaside, and he took out his drum and he started to play. He happened to be a very good drummer. And he started with a kind of a slow but enticing beat. Ba-dum, bum, 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 ba-dum, bum, bum, bum. And the sound of this drum went into the water and reached the ears of the big fish. Fish actually have ears. You don't see them, but they can feel it vibrationally. And then Zomo started to drum a slightly more lively beat. And The big fish couldn't help it. He wriggled up onto the shore. The big fish started to dance. Ba-dum-bum, a-bum-bum, a-ba-dum-bum, a-ba-dum-bum. And you know when you dance, you shake. And as he shook off all those scales. And then he went back into the water and down into the bottom of the sea to grow more scales, because for a fish he was naked and it was very embarrassing. Now, Zomo picked up all those scales and put them in his round hat. And he went off to find the wild cow. He knew where she hung out in the forest. He climbed a palm tree. He looked out, he saw her over there. "Hey, wild cow," he said. "Hmm?" she said. She was usually in a bad mood. "Hey, wild cow, I hear you're strong, but I don't think you're strong enough to knock over this spindly little tree." "Hmm?" said wild cow, and put down her head and charged that tree. Now, it happened to be a palm tree, and the palm tree is kind of soft. And you know what happened? The horns got stuck in the tree, and the wild cow couldn't move. And so Zomo shinnied down out of the tree, and he milked that wild cow into his drum. And now he had the scales, and now he had a drum full of milk. And he went to find the leopard. And now the thing about the leopard is that he had no enemies. He was so fierce, you know, that he was kind of relaxed. He did the same thing every day. He walked the same path at the same time. And that's what Zomo's cleverness used. Because what did he do? He reached into his hat and spread scales on the path. He reached into the drum and flicked some of that slippery milk onto the scales. And then he went down to the bottom of the path. It was a kind of steep hill, and hid behind this enormous boulder. Leopard set out, strutting, not paying attention. Why should he? And when he hit that slippery mess of scales and milk, his paws flew out from under him, and he rolled, dunk, 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 down to the bottom of the hill, clunk, and hit his head against that boulder, which knocked him out and also knocked out one tooth. With the tooth and the scales and the milk, Zomo went up to see Sky God and said, "I did it. And now will you make me wise?" And Sky God kind of sat back with that amused expression on his face. And he said, "You know, there are three things that are very important in life. They are courage. They are good sense. And there's caution. Now, Zomo, I have seen, oh, do you have courage? Good sense, kind of. And caution, forget it. So here's your wisdom. Next time you see big fish, wild cow, or leopard, you better run fast." And that is Rabbit's wisdom. He's been running fast, and so have his descendants from that day to this.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah. I love rabbits. I see a lot of them here. In
Rabbit the trickster. Rabbit who'll try anything.
Yes, yes. And I see them hiding sometimes when I've come upon them, and they're perfectly still.
Yes, they're really good at that. There he is and there he isn't. I mean, how do they move so fast? Because yeah. They got from Sky God, that's why.
Yes. Oh, that's wonderful. So where do these folktales come from?
Africa for the first one. I think Africa for both of them. And they come, I'm a library person. I still work in the library. And I get them from books, but then I play with them. I mean, I don't change the actual story, but I put myself into it and have so much fun.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Do you do any storytelling for?
Constantly.
Library?
I mean, I used to, in the old days where we were all together, you know, I would tell many stories to children and to grownups and this and that. Now I'm Zooming mostly. And I'm mostly telling personal stories. There isn't that much of a place to tell folk tales, except at a few swap groups I go to. So that's why I was so excited to have this opportunity. Okay. Are you ready for my personal stories?
I am.
Okay. So what was I, a New York City girl, doing living in this somewhat remote coastal town in Northern California? Well, I married a man from the Midwest who had come to the Big Apple for its excitements, but we had a kid, And he said, you know, New York is no place to bring up a kid. And I said, well, I grew up here. And he said, you know, there's just not that much freedom for a kid here. And I knew what he was talking about, but I wasn't going anywhere. I mean, my parents were here and my friends were here and my dance classes were here, but he was strategic. And so he said, well, look, theoretically, if we could move anywhere, where do you think you'd like to end up? I said, I need the ocean. I said, there is Boston, which I had been to a couple of times. And then there's San Francisco, which I'd never seen before, but was kind of intriguing. And you know what he did? He got a job in San Francisco. He said, are you coming? And of course I came. And San Francisco was great. And we had another kid and lived there for about 8 years. And but we spent most of our time in Golden Gate Park, because what our free time, because we had these kids. And then our landlord wanted the flat back. And so we, in effect, had to find a new place to live. And he said, how about that big green park across the Golden Gate Bridge? So we started poking around Marin County. And it felt very suburban to us. And we were hippies. So we didn't find a place until a Thanksgiving dinner that someone invited us to in this small coastal town. And it was only an hour away from San Francisco. And I was working in San Francisco. And it felt kind of like a fit for eccentrics like us. And I said, we could live here. And we started to look for a place, and there was almost nothing for rent. There were places to buy. And we never thought we'd buy something. But I'll tell you, his parents and my parents were very excited about the fact that we might actually land somewhere and stay. And so the place that was available, there were very few places available, was a very eccentric piece of property that had not sold for perhaps a year. It was the seat of an old farm, maybe about an acre, with five derelict buildings on it. And we looked at each other and we said, you know, we're not that good at making friends. We're so introverted. We could rent out these buildings and invite people we kind of like, form a community, not a commune, but we would have people around, kids would have other kids to play with. And that's what we did. Now, we had a barn. And of course, as new country dwellers, we immediately got chickens, we got goats, we got a pony for the kids to ride. And the chickens, they stopped laying and we didn't know what to do with them, so we got rid of them. And the goats, who started to grow and we didn't know how to trim them, and so we got rid of the goats. And the pony could stay outside. And this guy in town, opportunistic, came to us and he said, you know, I'm a carpenter and I can move into that barn and fix it up. It won't cost you a penny and you can rent it out to me. Sounded good. 50 years later, he's still there. And the other buildings, they got filled with people, and people came and people went. And sometimes it was a fabulous fit. Sometimes it was a little weird. But I would say for about 25 out of my 50-year-old stay there, it's been pretty solid. The guy in the barn is still there. A couple of my cousins are living in separate houses. And downstairs lives a landscape gardener who knows about the land, which I don't. And she'll say, Neshama, this needs attention. And she has a crew and it gets attention. So we don't necessarily, like a family, we don't necessarily get along that well. But we all, this is our home. And we all want to stay there. And we make do. I have to tell you, it's right on the San Andreas Fault. And who knows, the earthquake may come. The tsunami may come, the forest fires may come, but until they do, long live the Franklin Farm.
Oh, that's beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. And am I looking at you in a room in the Franklin Farm?
Yeah, definitely. This is upstairs.
Oh,
and upstairs, my neighbor lives downstairs. And as you can see, my life is a collage. You
know, yes.
There's no room on the walls. So
I'm looking at the art behind you, which looks fantastic.
Yeah, it's just, you have a long life, a lot of acquisition, you get a lot of stuff. It speaks to me. So, ready for the last story?
I am. Please, plunge us in.
Let's plunge. Okay. So, a number of years ago, I was an editor on a visionary magazine. It was started a few towns up in this coastal remote place that we live, by a doctor who had graduated from Yale. But when he took a look at the medical establishment, he said, no, He said, this is a mess. I think people can do it themselves by gaining knowledge. And the name of the magazine was Medical Self-Care. And there was nothing like it around then. It was very heady to work on such a thing. Now, in my very own town, there was another doctor, another renegade doctor. And when he graduated and looked at the medical establishment, he decided he was really a writer at heart, and he would write about holistic health. And he loved to write. And there was a lot burgeoning in those days, but people didn't know a lot about it. And I had the bright idea, watch those bright ideas, that I could put these two visionaries together and the sparks would fly, and who knows, it might just synergistically change the world. Now, the best place to do this might be at a dinner party, and I'm not the hostess with the mostest, and our place wasn't that big and kind of chaotic. So the writer said, you can come to our house. And I, being the hostess, said, I'll bring the food. Now, I was at that time a rather adventuresome cook, and I had learned how to make calzone, which are kind of like pizza turnovers. And so to do that, you have to make dough. And I had mixed up the dough, and it was resting in the bowl, and it had to rise in a warm place. And I live in a drafty old farmhouse. There was one room that stayed warm, and I put it in that room, and I closed the door and waited for the 2 hours that it takes for the dough to rise. And then I tried to open the door of that room, and it had locked itself. I mean, was it poltergeist? Was it portents? I think it was funky old hardware. But in any case, the dough was inside and I needed that dough. So what could I do? There was this kind of primitive wooden ladder, and I scaled, it was our version of a fire escape outside the building. So I climbed up on that ladder to the second floor, and I pushed up the window, and ass over tea kettle, I hurled myself in and I seized the bowl of dough. I was not going to risk climbing down, holding it. I lowered it on a rope, and then I climbed down myself, and then I punched it down, and then I made the calzone, and we were all ready to go. Now, I thought to round out these visionaries and their spouses, I would bring a couple of what we call allopathic doctors who happened to be married to each other, who happened to be liberal. They were delightful people. And I said, this will make such an interesting dinner party. And we drove up to the writer's house, and it didn't feel quite right. The house looked kind of peculiar. And I called for him, and he came skulking out of the bushes, and he looked stricken. He said, I simply forgot. The house is being tented for termites. We can't go in there. We're going to have to eat at these picnic tables. And so we sat at the picnic tables, and I put out the feast of calzone, and we all tucked in along with the yellow jackets, who were very excited about the calzone and about the humans. And so as we chomped and tried to wave the bugs away, I waited for the sparks to fly, and they did. But unfortunately, they were the sparks of two battling egos. And this is not going to change the world. It just exhausted us until the calzones were gone and we could leave, thank God. And we got in the car to take this couple back home. And I had kind of forgotten that my husband is a bit of a trickster. And so there we were in the dark on this dirt road, and just for, oh, I don't know how long, he turned off the headlights, and you could hear those doctors go, ah! And I was sure that they were afraid. Not only would they lose their calzone, but they might lose their lives. And luckily, John turned the headlights on, and we delivered them relatively safe and sound, if shook, to their house. And when I got home, I said to myself, no more bright ideas, Neshama, because I realized that in those calzones, in addition to vegetables, was stuffed crow.
I didn't see that coming.
Okay. Okay, there you have it. So that's what I have for you today. Love to tell stories, and I've been doing it for 30, 40 years. So, you know, I have a lot to tell.
Oh, that's great. Well, then we will definitely stay in touch.
And now, let me slip out of the warm cocoon that Neshama Franklin has spun around me, bringing back the emotions of remembering my father's stories. And now we are going to take a break for station identification. We are a community-based storytelling radio show broadcast on KPFT 90.1 FM, Houston Community Radio, also broadcast at 91.9 in Huntsville, 89.5 in Galveston, and anywhere on the internet as kpft.org HD1. Our show, So What's Your Story?, is broadcast every Wednesday at 6 p.m. Central Time. But as you will hear, you can listen to the show after it has been aired. Yes, just visit our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild at houstonstorytellers.org, where you can replay any of our previous shows from So What's Your Story? By selecting the radio show tab. Want to become a storyteller? Join the Houston Storytellers Guild and attend their monthly swap on the fourth Tuesday of the month. Check out their calendar at houstonstorytellers.org and grab the Zoom information for the next virtual swap. That one is scheduled for January 26th. Again, go check out that Zoom information on their events tab. There's also a lot to look forward to in 2024 with the March Texas Storytelling Festival in Denton, Texas, and the June Texas Storytelling Association Conference in Houston. Our friends at the Moth are back at Warehouse Live in person. The Story Slam is held on the second Tuesday of the month. Next one up is January 9th, and the theme is First Impressions. They have a new location. It's called Warehouse Live Midtown, and it is at 2600 Travis Street. Check out themoth.org live storytelling events and their Facebook page, The Moth in Houston, for updates on their event and how to buy tickets. We have just celebrated the new year. Yes, we started with our storyteller new to the show. Now I'd like to bring back a very memorable show from the past, because after all, New Year's is a time when we remember the past and welcome the new. I've been able to remember my father as the past and welcome Neshama as the new. Now I'm going to switch gears and bring back a very memorable show from the past. One of my favorite shows, where I was actually a guest of our former co-host, Warren Holloman, was the one I will play with you, with Danny Kaye telling the original Rumpelstiltskin fairy tale, and with me reading the updated version in Rumpelstiltskin's Daughter. This will always be one of my favorite old and new versions of the fairy tale.
So we're going to play the traditional Rumpelstiltskin, then you're going to give a modern version. And so we're starting with Rumpelstiltskin. Who's reading this?
Well, this is going to be Danny Kaye.
Yeah.
And it dawns on some of us that some of us may not know who Danny Kaye was. Danny Kaye was an entertainer in the 1950s and 60s when there were these entertainers that I think were, you could consider the transition from vaudeville to television today. One of the really interesting things about Danny Kaye, who was a singer and he read stories and he was an actor and he was in movies, he was the original Walter Mitty in the 1947 movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there's another one that's been updated.
He was omnipresent when I was young. He was on TV. Sort of the vaudeville comes to TV kind of performance.
He was. Yeah. He was.
Well, let's roll it, Nicole. Danny Kaye telling Rumpelstiltskin.
Once in a faraway land, there was a very, very poor man who had a very beautiful daughter. Now, it happened one day that he met the king. And he wanted to make himself seem rather important. "I," he said grandly, "have a daughter who can spin straw into gold." "How interesting," said the king. "Bring her to my palace and I will put her to the test." When the girl was brought to him, he took her into a room full of straw, gave her a spinning wheel, and said, "If by tomorrow morning you have not spun this straw into gold, you must die." Then he locked the door and left her in the room, all alone.
"Oh, dear," cried the girl. "Whatever shall I do?"
Because, of course, she had no idea at all how to spin straw into gold. But suddenly, the door opened. And in stepped a little man.
"Good evening, girl," he said. "Why are you crying so?"
Alas, I have to spin this straw into gold, and I don't know how to do it.
What will you give me if I do it for you? Asked the little man.
I am very poor, she wept, and I have nothing of value to give you.
Well then, said the little man, will you promise to give me your first child if you should become queen?
Queen, thought the girl. Me? I'll never become queen.
So she promised. And the little man sat himself in front of the wheel with a handful of straw. The straw became gold. He worked until daybreak, and by then all the straw was spun, and the room was full of gold. Early in the morning, the king came, and when he saw the gold, he could hardly believe his eyes. This is only a poor man's daughter, he thought. But where can I find a richer bride? And he said to the girl, you shall be my queen. So they were married. And a year later, they had a beautiful child. When the young queen's baby was exactly 1 week old, the strange little man suddenly appeared in her room. Now, he said, you must give me what you promised.
Oh, no. Anything else, cried the queen. Take all my riches, but leave me my child. And she wept and moaned and begged, and finally he said,
very well. I will give you 3 days. If in that time you can find out my name, you may keep your baby.
During the night, the queen lay awake, trying to remember all the names she had ever heard. And when the little man came the next day, she began.
Jonathan? Joseph? Jeremiah? Timothy? Titus? Obadiah? William Henry Walter Sim? Reuben? Rufus Solomon? Jim? Nathaniel? Daniel? Abraham? Roderick? Frederick? Peter? Sam? Casper, Jasper, Nicholas, Pat, Christopher, Jack, Jehoshaphat.
No, 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 no. At last she had said all the names she knew, and the little man laughed and went away. That night the queen sent a messenger out to discover every unusual name that anyone in the countryside knew of. And the next day she had another long list.
Xavier, Xerxes, Zittleby, Zorch.
But the little man said, no, 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 no.
And again he went away. And again the queen sent her messenger out. But when he came back on the last morning, he said, not another name have I been able to find, Your Majesty.
Oh, no, she wept. No.
But I did see something strange, said the messenger. Far out at the edge of the forest, I saw a little house, and in front of it, a bonfire was burning. And in front of the fire, a strange little man, hopping on one foot and singing,
today I brew, tomorrow I bake, and then the young queen's child I'll take. Oh, she'll lose the guessing game, for Rumpelstiltskin is my name.
Oh, thank you, cried the queen.
Soon afterwards, the little man appeared.
Now, Your Majesty, he thundered. What is my name?
The queen smiled.
Perhaps, Tom?
No.
Maybe. Dick?
Now.
Well then, said Her Majesty, there's nothing left but
Rumpelstiltskin.
You guessed it, shrieked the little man. I won't have it, I won't stand for it. And he stamped his right foot into the ground so hard that he sank up to his waist. Then he stamped his left leg so hard that he disappeared completely.
And Rumpelstiltskin was never seen again.
If you're just joining us, this is So What's Your Story on 90.1 FM KPFT Houston. Down in Galveston, you can catch us at 89.5, and in Huntsville, 91.9. And if you're anywhere in the world or even in outer space, our astronauts listen to us online at www.kpft.org. I'm Warren Holloman. My guest tonight is, well, of course, that was Danny Kaye, and here in the flesh is Mary Edgerton. So, Mary, what do you think about that story? What stands out to you?
You know, what was really horrible to me every time I read the story, and it was horrible. I mean, the man that she ends up marrying had threatened to kill her several times, and then this little man saves her life but wants her oldest child, and then at the very end, he just rips himself in two. Is that not horrible?
Well, I think how easy we have it these days. We go to for counseling for things that are relatively minor compared to that.
I think that's traumatic.
Yeah. Is there a point to this story, a moral, a main point?
Well, you know, what I found online is what I mentioned before, is that this is something to do with beware, wary of the folly of trade, and was related to humans interacting with Neanderthals. And and as I say, to me, the king is the Neanderthal in all of them.
Well, and I think we were joking earlier that sometimes we think it's graduate students looking for a dissertation topic, but I do believe that folk tales and stories are not univocal. They have a multiplicity of meanings, multiple meanings. And you can, five different people can listen to a story and hear five different things. And that's what's so powerful about stories. We were talking earlier about a book that some professors at University of Houston have published. Hank, in fact, is one of the authors. And one of the chapters is on Rumpelstiltskin. It's a story, it's a book about called Lessons in Mythology. But one of the chapters on Rumpelstiltskin explores some of the theories about the folk tale, that it's speaking to some of the male concerns of the day that usually are not spoken of overtly. One reading, for example, is that this is a story that's about... I'm sorry, that this is a subliminal way of talking about what it's like being gay. You know, a man has a paternal instinct, a desire to have children, but he doesn't have a, quote, mating instinct. And in some ways, he's the opposite, unfortunately, of a lot of men who have the mating instinct
without the fathering instinct.
Yeah.
And so true.
And then another way to look at it, it could be a story about male impotence. A man wants a child but can't have one. Can't father them. So, I mean, we can see all kinds of things in there.
Well, I think you're right. Yeah. Every person sees a new one. But, you know, I'd like to take the Rumpelstiltskin story along a different direction. And I'm going to read you an updated version.
I can't wait.
I just fell in love with this. So let's go back to that third night when the king has said, you have to turn the straw into gold or you die. And if you do it, you get to marry me. Mm-hmm. Rumpelstiltskin comes in. That's quite a pile, he said. I suppose you want me to spin it into gold. Well, the situation has changed just a bit, said the miller's daughter, who also had a name. It was Meredith. If you don't, I will die. If you do, I marry the king. Well, now that, thought Rumpelstiltskin, has possibilities. After all, getting to be the queen was a big step up for the miller's daughter. She would surely pay him anything. And there was only one thing in the world he really wanted, a little child to love and care for. Okay, here's the deal, he said. I will spin the straw into gold, just like before. In return, once you become queen, you must let me adopt your firstborn child. I promise I'll be an excellent father. I know all the lullabies. I'll read to the child every day. I'll even coach Little League. You've got to be kidding, Meredith said. I'd rather marry you than that jerk. Really? Said Rumpelstiltskin. And he blushed all the way from the top of his head to the tip of his toes, which admittedly wasn't very far because he was so short. Sure, she said. I like your ideas on parenting. You'd make a good provider. And I have a weakness for short men. So Rumpelstiltskin spun a gold ladder and they escaped out the window. They were married the very next day and lived happily together, far, far away from the palace. Meredith and Rumpelstiltskin lived a quiet country life, raising chickens and growing vegetables. Every now and then, when they needed something they couldn't make or grow, Rumpelstiltskin would spin up a little gold to buy it with. Now, they had a daughter, and she was just as sunny and clever as you would expect her to be, having such devoted parents. When she was 16, they decided she ought to see more of the world. So every now and then, they allowed her to take the gold into town to exchange it for coins and to do a little shopping. The goldsmith grew curious about the pretty country girl who came in with those odd coils of gold. He mentioned it to his friend the baker, who mentioned it to the blacksmith, who mentioned it to the tax collector, who hurried to the palace and told the king. It may not surprise you to learn that the king hadn't changed a bit. If anything, he was greedier than before. As he listened, his eyes glittered. "I once knew a miller's daughter who could make gold like that," he said. "Unfortunately, she got away. Let's make sure this one doesn't." So the next time Rumpelstiltskin's daughter went to see the goldsmith, two of the king's guards were waiting for her. In a red-hot minute, she was in a carriage and speeding toward the palace. And what she saw on the way broke her heart. Everywhere the fields lay barren. Sickly children stood begging beside the road. Nobody in the kingdom had anything anymore because the king had it all. Finally, they reached the palace. There were high walls around it and a moat full of crocodiles. Armed guards were everywhere, gnashing their teeth, clutching their swords, and peering about with shifty eyes. As the carriage went over the bridge and under the portcullis, the hungry people shook their fists at them. It was not a pretty sight. Rumpelstiltskin's daughter was taken at once to the grand chamber where the king sat on his golden throne. He didn't waste time on idle pleasantries. "Where did you get this?" he asked, showing her the gold. Said Rumpelstiltskin's daughter. "I thought so," said the king. "Guards, take her to the tower and see what she can do with all that straw." Rumpelstiltskin's daughter looked around. She saw a pile of straw the size of a bus. She saw a locked door and high windows. She gave a big sigh and began to think. She knew her father could get her out of this pickle, but she had heard stories about the king all her life. One room full of gold would never satisfy him. Her father would be stuck here, spinning until there was not an iota of straw left in the kingdom. After a while, she climbed the pile of straw and thought some more. She thought about the poor farmers and about the hungry children with their thin faces and sad eyes. She put the two thoughts together and cooked up a plan. Then Rumpelstiltskin's daughter curled up and went to sleep. The next day, the king was very disappointed. "Where's my gold?" he wanted to know. "I'm sure you have rooms full of it upstairs," said Rumpelstiltskin's daughter. And she was right, he did. "But I want more," he said, "and I want you to make it for me." "Alas," she said, "I never made gold in my life. But," and here she paused for effect, "I saw my grandfather make it." When the king's face brightened, she added, "Oh, he died years ago." "Surely you remember how he did it," cried the king. "Think, think." "Well," she said slowly, "there is one thing I'm sure of. He didn't spin it, he grew it." The next morning, the king and Rumpelstiltskin's daughter got into his glittering coach with two guards up front and two guards behind and a huge bag of gold inside. They drove under the portcullis over the bridge and out into the countryside. At the first farm they came to, they stopped and sent for the farmer. He was thin and ragged and barefoot. So were his wife and children. "Now tell the farmer he must plant this gold coin in his field, and you will come back in the fall to collect everything it has grown. Tell him you will give him another gold coin for his pains," she whispered. "Oh, do I have to?" whined the king. "Well, I don't know," she said. "That's how my grandfather always did it." "Okay," said the king, "but this better work." He gave the farmer two gold coins, and they hurried on to the next farm. By the end of the week, they had covered the entire kingdom. All through the summer, the king was restless. "Is it time yet? Is the gold ripe?" "Wait," said Rumpelstiltskin's daughter. And finally August came and went. Now, she said, now you can go and see what is grown in the fields. So once again they piled into the glittering coach, and as they neared the first farm, the king gasped with joy. The field shone golden in the morning sun. Gold, he said. No, said Rumpelstiltskin's daughter, something better than gold. How can anything be better than gold, said the king. It's wheat, she said. You can eat it. You can't eat gold. Before the king could start turning purple, the farmer and his family came running towards a carriage. In their arms they carried baskets of wheat and barley and apples and green beans and pumpkins and corn and I don't know what all. They piled it into the wagon and kissed the king's hand, grinning ear to ear. I can promise you that nothing like that had ever happened to the king before. Well, he said sheepishly, maybe there will be gold at the next place. But everywhere it was the same. The land prospered, the children looked healthy, and the king was a hero. At the end of the week, they returned to the palace with all the food the wagons could carry. The cook was so overjoyed, he put on a sumptuous feast to celebrate. After dinner, the king spoke. Well, that was all very nice, my dear, he said. But you must have been mistaken. That was how your grandfather grew food, not how he made gold. Right, she said, as she pulled her shawl tightly around her shoulders and gazed longingly at the fire. Even in the palace she could feel the chill of autumn. Time for phase two, she thought. Of course you're right, she said. I told you it was long ago. But I think I remember now. He didn't grow gold. He knitted it with golden knitting needles. So the next day they loaded the coach with knitting needles, a bag of gold, and lots of yellow wool. And then they headed off, over the portcullis, under the bridge, and out into the countryside. At the first cottage they came to, they asked to see the granny. She hobbled to the door in her rags and curtsied to the king. Now, whispered Rumpelstiltskin's daughter, give her a bag of wool and a pair of needles. Tell her to knit it all up, and you will come back in a month to collect your riches. And give her a gold coin for your pains. Well, you can imagine that at the end of the month, when the king ordered his coach and wagons and rounded up his guards and went to see the grannies, what did he see? He thought he saw gold. And yes, it was gold. Gold, cried the king. Something better than gold, said Rumpelstiltskin's daughter. Your people will be warm all winter. They were clothed in things knitted from the gold wool. Everyone brought presents for the king. By the time he got back to his palace, he had 17 sweaters, 42 mufflers, 8 vests, 1 pair of knickers, 135 pairs of socks, 12 nightcaps, and a tam-o'-shanter, all the color of gold. Oh, do they suit me? Asked the king as he tried them on. Absolutely, said Rumpelstiltskin's daughter. Are you sure you don't remember how your grandfather made gold? Asked the king one day. I'm afraid not, she said. Oh, it's a terrible pity, he sighed. But you did try, and as a reward, I have decided to make you my queen. Oh, why don't you make me prime minister instead, suggested Rumpelstiltskin's daughter. And so the king did just that, and he built her a nice house near the palace, and once a month she took off time to visit her parents. Oh, and I forgot to tell you, Rumpelstiltskin's daughter had a name, too. It was Hope.
Oh, that's incredible. I love it. How did you find this story?
You know, my daughter was going to this really interesting school. We were in Nashville, and the teacher told us one time that they were updating the fairy tales in class, and maybe Cinderella didn't go off with the prince. And about the same time, a review of this came out in the New York Times Book Review, and I said, I have to have this book.
So, and for our listeners, then...
It is Rumpelstiltskin's Daughter by Diane Stanley. It's a wonderful book. I got it off Amazon. My friends loved it so much at work that I had to go order a bunch more copies and give to them.
And I have to say, I'm sitting beside you looking at the illustrations, which are worth the price of the book by themselves. The drawings reflect sort of the worst opulence, I think, of France before the Revolution. Just really overdone.
Yes,
stuff.
Yes.
For the king, I mean.
And we won't mention who has his house done in Louis the 14th gold right now.
Louis the 14th, yeah, that's it. Yeah, so that's a rather subversive story.
It is. And, you know, not only does she outsmart the king, she has all the people being fed. She shows him how important it is to be loved. And at the very end, she doesn't want to be queen. She wants to be prime minister. I just love every part of this.
I do, too. Do you know of any other folk tales that have been updated like that?
Well, Into the Woods is an update of many folk tales. And I have to tell you, just last weekend, I saw Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs at the Catastrophic Theater.
Yeah.
And that is quite updated. Snow White is pretty bored with those dwarves.
Yeah.
And that prince doesn't come along and pull through. it's quite a take on Snow White.
Yeah. Great. Well, thanks so much.
So everybody, happy New Year and welcome to the new year. And welcome to Remembrances of Older Times. Thank you for sharing my father's birthday with me by celebrating his wonderful many genres of storytelling with Neshama Franklin and her many genres. And of course, thank you all for listening to me playing these dueling versions of Rumpelstiltskin. You can go to the page, our Facebook page, So What's Your Story, and vote for which one you like the best. But don't leave. Stay tuned into KPFT because next up is Living Art with Michael Woodson and Michael Carson, a community art program that hosts artists from around Houston, including poets, writers, performance artists, visual artists, car artists, and others engaging in educating, promoting, and advancing art and artists in our Gulf region. So chill, relax, make Houston's community station, KPFT 90.1, a part of every day. And while you're driving home or just hanging, join us every Wednesday at 6 p.m. for So What's Your Story? It's a great way to make the hour go by. Keep loving these great stories, and we'll keep bringing them to you. This is Mary Edgerton, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we never want you to forget that even if a story doesn't end the way you want, remember, it's the journey and not the destination. Peace.